Well, good day and welcome back to this special episode of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we've got a clinical topic for you tonight, and we'll get into the nitty-gritty of that for you in just a bit. But of course, even especially with clinical topics, I think we need the expertise of my co-host, Sam Bradley, who has seen it all, done it all. Right, Sam?
Well, maybe most of it. I'm not sure. But I do know that our weather's a whole lot better than I feel so bad for you guys in the East Coast. We'll have to find out where you're at and why you're not going anywhere tomorrow. And it's certainly got to be Kyle's fault. What do you have to say for yourself, Kyle?
You're welcome.
Hey, and look, I work from home, so I'm easy. You know, it's easy for me to just put a fire in the fireplace and go ahead and stick around and watch the snow come down. But I mean, good grief, the fourth nor'easter in like 2.5 weeks coming up the coast and just hammering the Northeast has been quite interesting. And I'm curious, Kyle, is this a weather pattern that might stick around for another week?
Well, Jamie, it's definitely looking like that active pattern is going to stick around. We actually right now have a winter storm rolling on the East Coast, and the mountains of California are going to get dumped on with snow. And then, of course, you in your neck of the woods up there in the Northeast getting your fourth nor'easter now in the month of March. So definitely active pattern looks to stay around for you guys. But, you know, I would swear, if weather wasn't active, we wouldn't have anything to talk about on the show sometimes.
I don't disagree.
Welcome to
with
the first
you there. That's true.
Well,
speaking of which, Kyle, you just off air, you said something about one of your adventures in Anniston, and you and your teaching partner had to go to ground. That's a little scary. Tell us a little about that.
Sure. So here on March 20, when we're recording this, the evening prior, I was actually teaching a social media course down in Anniston, Alabama. And that evening was forecasted to be a very intense, severe weather period. We were able to move east to Atlanta ahead of the line of thunderstorms. However, they followed us there. And about 11 o'clock last night, as I was sitting in my hotel room, seeing the lightning get more intense and looking at things on the radar, there's something that just didn't feel right. So as I advocate for, you know, all my classes I teach and for all of you, if you don't feel safe where you are, like on the 13th floor of a hotel, then, you know, work your way down to a more safe location. So my colleague and I, we met up on the ground floor of that hotel and had two different locations picked out where we could quickly dive into a more sheltered location should the weather evolve. Thankfully, we were not impacted, but Jacksonville State University unfortunately did take a direct hit from an EF3 tornado last night.
Oh, really?
Thankfully, they were on spring break.
Oh, my God, I hadn't heard about that. Geez, well, I'll tell you what, when the meteorologists go to ground, I'd be right behind you. I wouldn't be questioning that. But Dr. Joe, didn't you catch a little bit of this storm going through in Memphis?
We had a little bit of nasty weather for a day or so, a lot of rain, and certainly a significant temperature change, but nothing like what Kyle had.
Or Jamie had, fortunately.
Or Jamie, that's true.
Well, spring will come to the East Coast eventually, I'm sure. It's already, my grass is growing and my Easter lily is about ready to sprout out here in Colorado. So I have nothing to complain about. But yeah, we're going to have a little clinical topic tonight. We haven't done that, have a family show. Joe came up with some good ideas, so we're going to put him to the task. But you want to talk about crest injuries, but a little bit different flavor than we just. I don't know. It's actually been quite a while. So why don't you tell us what you're thinking, Joe?
Oh, well, that's frightening if I do that, but I'll talk about crest syndrome instead.
Well, maybe I should raise that.
Yeah. So, you know, I think let's start by just talking a little bit about crest syndrome in general. It's certainly a topic we've covered here before and, you know, sort of falls in the purview of disaster medicine in a lot of different ways. But, you know, in essence, crest syndrome is a complete system-wide body system wide event that results from tissues, particularly muscle tissue, being compressed to the point where either the cell, the muscle cell particularly, ruptures because it's under such pressure, or the pressure results in ischemia, which ultimately results in cellular dysfunction, et cetera. And, you know, in the sort of more typical environment of disaster medicine, we see that when buildings collapse and, you know, structures fail and folks are trapped underneath large pieces of rubble. But, you know, part of the thing I want to talk about a little bit tonight was sort of how we actually, in many cases, see crush syndrome a lot more frequently than we realize that we do. And that can be everything from the rather simple and straightforward case of a patient who may develop a debilitating illness, a stroke or a hip fracture, for example, and collapse on a hard surface like a tile floor and be immobilized there for a long period of time before they're discovered. And I think it's important to remember that crush syndrome is really a time versus pressure kind of phenomena. So you can get crush syndrome from a lot of pressure in a fairly short period of time or a lesser amount of pressure over a much longer period of time. And they look different clinically. You know, the classic crush syndrome is fairly pronounced in its presentation. And that's because the things have happened fairly quickly and in many cases more quickly than the body's had an opportunity to compensate for. But in the example that we were just discussing with a patient who may have collapsed on a hard surface and their own body weight may be contributing to a crush syndrome, they'll have many of the same features that we see in crush syndrome, only in a more compensated state. And I think it's imperative that we in EMS particularly are alert for that. And just to expand on that a little bit further, one of the things that we have seen over the last year or so with the opioid epidemic is patients who have had a substantial amount of opioids on board and who have been symptomatically toxic from those opioids. And by that, I mean they've been fairly unresponsive for a period of time or used a fair amount of opioids in a fairly short period of time. We're beginning to see patients who have significant amounts of rhabdomyolysis that occurs from their unconscious state, again, where they're collapsed on the floor for a significant period of time. And they develop rhabdo fairly commonly. And, you know, that's not a group of patients that we normally expect to see that in. But I think what's really important from an EMS provider standpoint is to realize that in many cases, there's more going on than just the opioid overdose. And in cases where patients have been overdosed on opioids and are unresponsive for some period of time, and may have been lying in the same position for many hours, may have, you know, inadvertently cut off the circulation to their arm or their leg just due to the strange position that they're lying in or that sort of stuff. They may well have been that way for many hours, and EMS is ultimately contacted when some, you know, friend, bystander, or family member notices that they're not breathing as well anymore. You know, then we're engaged. And so we treat those patients as an opioid overdose. We give them some Narcan, and they you know, they wake up, quote unquote, and then of course they don't want to go to the hospital. But I think it's imperative that in patients with opioid overdose, we look a little further for a not insignificant number of those patients that have signs and symptoms of rhabdo and actually Crush syndrome that we need to be looking for, because those are potentially life-threatening conditions that may not be apparent in a very superficial manner or superficial look at those patients.
And it's interesting you talk about that, Joe, because it's more like it's almost like a compression, instead of a compressional crush syndrome, which is what we traditionally think of, i.e. the crush, we're talking about a positional type of crush syndrome.
Oh, you're exactly right, Jamie, and that's exactly the issue. You know, I think if you just take a look at the media coverage online of patients that are, you know, found in opiate overdose, they are in extremely unusual positions. You know, they're unconscious, sort of doubled over in the front seat of a car. They're on a park bench. They're in all kinds of weird positions where, you know, they may well have inadvertently obstructed the blood flow to their lower extremity for 4 hours prior to someone finding them or recognizing that they're in trouble. And then, you know, we come in, it's pretty obviously a heroin overdose or an opioid overdose of some sort, and we treat that patient with Narcan, and they sort of wake up and start breathing again. And you know, we give them a cursory once over and send them on their merry way, or we try to take them to the hospital, but obviously many times they don't want to go. Yet in reality, those patients have an significant ischemic injury that has been present for many hours and is unrecognized. And then once they're awake enough to sort of straighten up and, you know, get their leg out from under them or whatever the weird situation is that may have resulted in a tourniqueting type effect on an extremity, they begin to reperfuse that extremity, just like in Crush syndrome, and begin to exhibit many of the same signs and symptoms that we see in Crush syndrome.
So Joe, how would you parallel Crush syndrome with compartment syndrome? Because it kind of sounds like that we could be talking about that kind of thing, too.
Yeah, they are similar. I think the big difference is, you know, sort of viewing compartment syndrome as the bad stuff is going on in a contained compartment within, you know, an extremity, for example, or the abdomen or something like that. And that the most significant bad effects are sort of localized or at least contained, as compared to a crush syndrome, where the initial onset and the initial pathophysiology is very similar. But what you're seeing in crush syndrome is the same effects, but as they apply to the entire body in a more systemic kind of fashion. So the issues around, you know, rhabdomyolysis and you know, kidney-related issues, electrolyte abnormalities and cardiac-related issues, all of those sort of things all are being manifested in crush syndrome that might not be as significantly manifested in a compartment syndrome, again, just because it's a bit more isolated from the overall circulation in the body.
Joe, could you give us kind of a quick basic understanding for those that may not understand what rhabdo is and what it does? I know it can have some long-range effects.
Well, it absolutely can. And so let me even back up sort of one layer higher and talk about crush syndrome in general. So the basic pathophysiology here is muscle, which tends to be the most the tissue that's most likely to be affected and involved in a crush or compartment type syndrome. The muscle tissue is ischemic and or directly traumatized by being crushed or you know, flow occluded in some sort of way. And so those muscle cells either are broken open directly by the trauma itself, or become ischemic, and many of them die and they sort of rupture due to the ischemia. And what happens is the stuff that's supposed to be inside the cell, primarily myoglobin, which is the big muscle protein, which is a very large protein, much like hemoglobin, floats around in the bloodstream and gets caught up in the filtering system in the kidney, and results in basically it sort of plugs up the filter and results in renal failure to some extent. The other thing that happens is that inside the cell are higher levels of potassium, and when large number of cells rupture and leak all that potassium into the circulatory system, they circulate around and raise serum potassium levels. And that can result in cardiac arrhythmias, et cetera. That can actually be worsened by the fact that in many cases the cell has gone into an anaerobic metabolism, which is sort of a rescue type metabolism is a rudimentary effort by the cell to stay alive when it can't get enough oxygen. And it's a very inefficient metabolic process that produces lots of side related chemicals, particularly things like lactic acid and that sort of stuff. And of course, that lactic acid leaks out, and that makes the bloodstream quite acidic. That makes the heart much more sensitive to the effects of elevated potassium levels. It makes the kidney much more likely to have trouble passing the myoglobin molecule through the kidney and out of the body and all that sort of stuff. So that's sort of CRUSH syndrome in a nutshell. You usually die from CRUSH syndrome from elevated potassium levels and the cardiovascular effects of that, combined with a severe state of acidosis. And if that doesn't get you, then you die later on from renal failure, from the kidneys being sort of blocked up, if you will, the filtering system being blocked up by the myoglobin molecule.
Wow, complex. So, Kyle, have you ever run across something like that in ski patrol? I'm thinking about that out-of-bound skier that may have fallen into a strange position and it takes a while to find him. Have you run across that?
No, not personally. I have not run across it. That would be more common for our mountain rescue teams here in Colorado to encounter, for those backcountry skiers or out-of-bound skiers that become injured or otherwise incapacitated, and through some of the same mechanisms that Joe was describing, get into a kind of an awkward position for the body that affects blood flow and circulation to certain parts of the body, including extremities. And compounded with other environmental factors, I'm sure that this actually does occur more often than folks think.
Jamie, have you run across this in your world?
Well, and I'm thinking, I think as Joe's pointed out, maybe I've run across it and wasn't aware of what I was seeing necessarily, because of how he describes this. I've certainly had numerous elderly patients who've fallen and been found on the floor of the kitchen or the bathroom after a prolonged period of time down and found by a relative. I'm curious, Joe, because a lot of the things you're talking about going on here are really detectable only by lab results. So are there, aside from just general suspicion of what might be going on the surface, are there any signs and symptoms that we can keep an eye out for that might clue us in that this is indeed what's happening?
Well, I think you hit on it nicely, Jamie. And the first point here is obviously to sort of think about, is this going on? One of the things that you really want to look for, and again, I'll reemphasize the issue with the opioid overdose patient, because we're starting to see this much more commonly in opioid overdoses than we have in the past. And I don't know if it's just because the volume of those patients is so significantly greater than it used to be, or we just never really paid enough attention. But if you have a patient that has swelling of an extremity or a muscle group, you know, whether that's the arms or legs or whatever, I would certainly be worried about that kind of stuff. I think one of the most important messages that I want to get out is that in any patient you feel like might have the potential for a crush syndrome type situation, we have a great tool for, in EMS to identify those patients that have the life threat potential. And that's as simple as doing an EKG on those patients. So I would highly encourage every EMS provider who sees a patient that is an opioid overdose, that might have some swelling, that may have been in that position for some time, the elderly patient that may have well been immobilized for some hours and on the floor or whatever, to consider doing a 12-lead EKG on those patients, looking particularly for the signs of increased potassium levels, hyperkalemia. And that can be noted in the fact that the T wave is tall and peaked compared to a more normal EKG. So it's a super easy tool to do. It costs virtually nothing. It doesn't hurt the patient in any way. It can be valuable in so many ways to help identify those patients that may have life-threatening hyperkalemia and it, at least warn you that this patient is one at risk and two may well already be showing signs and symptoms of the disease process and allow you to initiate therapy earlier on and to alert the caregivers that you're going to be turning that patient over to check for, you know, rhabdomyolysis and potassium levels and cardiac monitoring and IV fluid rehydration and all that sort of stuff that we would use to treat those patients.
Joe, isn't there some significant pain involved? I'm just thinking about when your arm goes to sleep, when you, you know, put it under your head and you fall asleep that way. So it would seem there would be significant amount of pain if somebody was in a position like that for a period of time.
Well, I think you're exactly right, Sam, that they often are. But in a patient who is on significant doses of opiates, their pain receptors are kind of blocked up with opiates, and they may well not be very symptomatic from a pain standpoint, despite the fact that you know, they may have significant muscle injury going on. So it's important to think about that. It's important not to assume that all the patient, all the pain that a patient who has been, who has fallen, for example, and been immobilized on the floor for, you know, 14 hours is all related to their hip fracture. It may well be other ischemic muscle pain that's going on at the same time.
Wow, really good point. So I'm sure you've seen your share of this in your USAR work, did you not?
Yeah, there's you know, that's kind of been the classic purview of crush syndrome in general is from the USAR environment. But I think as we have better understood what's going on in that environment and that pathophysiology, we're coming to appreciate that it's a much more common disease process than we thought before, albeit in a more compensated form. So, for example, the patient that might have been on the floor for 14 hours is, you know, had a longer period of time to develop ischemia, had the body be able to respond to that, buffer the acid that's being produced, all those sort of things. So, you know, it's very much a spectrum of disease in many ways. And, you know, at one end of the spectrum is the obvious, I have, you know, 14 tons of concrete laying on both legs, that and I'm about to be extricated from that situation. Those are pretty obvious. But on the other end of that spectrum, those patients have very much the same disease process going on, albeit more buffered by the body and with a longer and sort of slower timeline to it. But now we're beginning to see that more acute timeline occurring in patients with opiate overdoses. So I'll reiterate here again, if you've got a patient with an opiate overdose, do an EKG on them. Look for signs and symptoms of hyperkalemia before you sort of treat and release those patients.
Well, Joe, it seems like most areas that I'm familiar with have a CRUSH protocol for ALS. I assume you have something like that in Memphis. What are the basics for treatment in the field if they do discover it?
So that's a great question, Sam. So the treatment for the CRUSH syndrome in general is sort of multi-pronged. And, the first thing you want to do is to make certain that you have restored the circulating volume in the vascular system. The other thing that IV fluids do is help to dilute the potassium levels. They dilute the acidosis. They dilute the amount of myoglobin that's in any, cubic centimeter of blood. So dilution is a good thing there because you're trying to lower those levels overall. The treatment for the hyperkalemic or high potassium portion of CRUSH syndrome is pretty well known for most folks in the medical field, and that's the use of medications like sugar, D50, D10, something like that, and insulin, because insulin requires potassium to drive glucose inside the cell. So if we give those two medications, we help push potassium into the cell, and that's a good thing. That's where it needs to be. The other thing that we want to do is correct the acidosis that's going on in CRUSH syndrome. We do that by administration of sodium bicarb. That works to obviously combat the lactic acid that's floating around, which reduces our sensitivity to the high potassium levels. But that also has a tremendous effect on the solubility of the myoglobin molecule in the kidney. And so if we can reduce the pH of the urine from, say, 7.5, which is about normal, to 6.5 or even 7.0, we can increase the solubility of myoglobin many-fold. And basically what we can do is ensure that the kidney in that more alkalinized state is able to pass the myoglobin through and excrete it from the body so that it doesn't plug up the filtering system.
What about albuterol?
Albuterol is also an excellent choice. It doesn't seem like it would be a drug that we would use very commonly in that situation because it is a beta agonist type drug designed to, bronchodilate and all that sort of stuff. Its value in CRUSH syndrome is that one of the side effects of the use of albuterol and other beta agonists is that they drive potassium into the cell. And so we can use that side effect to our advantage in those patients. I'll also throw in another little clinical pearl here, which is to think about the use of albuterol, especially this time of year when we're seeing a lot of respiratory illness in children with RSV and croup and flu and everything else. That kids especially who are having a significant bout of a bronchospastic respiratory disease like RSV or whatever, and who have had large doses of beta agonists in an effort to help them reduce their bronchospasm, often get sort of floppy and may well can get into trouble. And that is often related to the fact that we have driven their serum potassium levels down very low by the continuous use of albuterol. And to be aware that, that is a side effect of albuterol, which can work to our favor, but can also work to our disadvantage if we're not paying attention to it. So those patients need to be monitored carefully for hypokalemia in cases where they've had massive doses of albuterol.
Yeah, it sounds like a critical balance issue. So I think the real pearl here is recognizing the potential and then getting them on an EKG to kind of verify that and then, go with the treatment. But you won't treat it if you don't suspect it, right?
Well, that's exactly it. And again, that's kind of the reason for the whole topic tonight is because we are seeing this occurring in a relatively new patient population that we had never thought about this much before, and that is the opiate overdose patient, that we really need to be paying attention to that. We need to be looking for it. We have to think about it in order to even look for it. And we actually have a tool that's a fairly simple and easy tool to use to ensure that we're not seeing signs and symptoms of hyperkalemia and ultimately Crush syndrome.
So, Kyle, you're duly educated. What do you think now?
Well, this is a neat discussion, you know, really kind of taking the deep dive into this, and it really has kind of opened my mind. But it also kind of harkens back to the some of the basics, I feel like, where, you know, just being aware of what potential other things could be affecting, you know, your patient based on their environment, how you found them, and, you know, other questions that you obtained through your scene size up and then your assessment, but also doing a thorough head-to-toe assessment on each patient, you know, and being careful not to make some of those assumptions that we may fall into as we progress through our careers.
Kyle, you threw an interesting question into the chat room. You want to ask Joe about that?
Yeah. So, Joe, the question I had in there was that I was just thinking about some of our patients that are bedridden or spend a lot of time laying down, and they can sometimes get bed sores. And as we were talking about Crush syndrome and how that can also be very hyperlocalized in the body, are bed sores a type of hyperlocalized Crush syndrome where that patient's body has pressure points against the bed?
Yeah, Kyle, that's extremely insightful and intuitive. You know, that is exactly what a bed sore is. It is a hyperlocalized Crush syndrome. And, you know, I think what's different about that is that the what's happening to cause the bed sore, which is, you know, pressure on an area that causes ischemia and ultimately tissue breakdown and tissue loss and, you know, a big ulcer at some point because all the tissue has died off, is the same process that we see in Crush. What's a little bit different with the bed sore issue is that the just like we talked about earlier in patients where they've been down on the floor for some period of time, the body has had time to compensate for that. The area where the bed sore has formed has to some extent separated itself from the body, and I mean that in terms of there's vascular compromise in that area. The pressure's been there for a very long time. The vessels have, blocked off, and there's, you know, lack of flow in there, et cetera. And so as those tissues break down locally, there's not an awful lot of spread of all the things we've been talking about into the more central circulation, simply because the area has sort of walled itself off. Because it's taken a long time for that process to occur. And so the body's had an opportunity to sort of put up some roadblocks by having some vessels close off and, you know, just stop refusing that area altogether. And therefore, the issues related to, the flow of potassium and acid and all that sort of stuff back into the central circulation can occur because those blood vessels have all closed themselves off and there is no contact with the central circulation much anymore.
Wow, that's interesting, Joe. There's just some perspectives we haven't thought about before, and I'm certainly re-educated, and I think the real pearl here is just to be aware of it, especially, you know, we've never thought about it so much in terms of the opiate overdose population, and I feel guilty because I just had a training on that, and I wish I would have thought to include that. So next time I will. But Jamie, are you duly educated?
I am duly educated, and this is one of the, you know, one of the just amazing benefits that we have as hosts, and also our audience has having a resource like Joe around to kind of open our eyes to things that we probably have seen and didn't know what we were looking at. And I appreciate that, because I think that there's always opportunities to educate ourselves and see things from a different angle and a different perspective. And, you know, the thing that makes Joe so valuable in this podcast are also the same things that make Joe and his rest of his team so valuable in the Paragon Medical Education Group arena, with what they do in their unique educational programs, where they teach people how to see beyond what they always thought they were looking at and look at something from a different perspective entirely, so that they gain new insights and understanding. And Joe, you guys just do such a fantastic job with that. And so I'm curious, you know, what do you apply these kind of things all the time in your training, I guess?
Well, thank you, Jamie. I mean, you said that very nicely, and I appreciate that. You know, that is very much what we're about, which is trying to see beyond the surface and see the more subtle aspects of what's really going on. And we work very hard to do that, whether that's a disaster-related scenario or a procedural-related lab. Or an active shooter situation where folks can appreciate what things are like on the surface, but understand that there's an awful lot of things that are happening just under the surface that are phenomenally important in the overall outcome of the situation and the patient.
So where can folks find more information about what you guys are doing, maybe upcoming programs you have available, or especially how to bring your training and your system of unique educational opportunities to their system and their jurisdiction?
Sure. Well, we always love talking to people. I think one of the things we want to stress is that it's a completely customizable experience based on what folks are looking for. And we're more than happy to spend as much time as we need talking to folks about how we can make it work for them. But that all starts with them reaching out to us and starting that conversation. And so if they could find us on the web at paragonmedicalgroup.com or on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group, they can always reach out to us through the Disaster Podcast website or even through the Disaster Podcast Facebook group.
Yeah, and I just have to stress, you know, it doesn't cost you anything to just reach out and talk to Joe and the gang over there, because you'd be surprised how they can find opportunities and ways to bring their training into your system, and you won't be sorry, and you're going to get a big thank you from the rest of your teams because of just how wowed they're going to be by what they've experienced in the program. So reach out to them. You can always find them in links on our episodes and our main page at disasterpodcast.com, but reach out to Joe and Jim and the rest of the folks at Paragon. Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. So feel free to follow along with me on Twitter and Instagram and connect with me on LinkedIn to continue the conversation.
And remember, if you run into Kyle at a hotel and he's hanging out on the first floor of the building, stay close.
I was just going to say that. Wherever Kyle goes, I'll be right behind him. Oh, my.
Oh, wow.
You guys.
Sam, where can folks find you?
Behind Kyle. Oh, we're off of that. Well, actually, the same place as you find Kyle and or Joe, in the usual social media places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11 on the disasterpodcast.com website and in our Facebook group, which seems to be having a lot of activity going on over there. So please join us. And as Kyle says, join the conversation. How about you, Jamie?
Well, you can find me under the handle Podmedic in almost all the social media spots out there. So friend, follow me or otherwise keep in touch with me there. And join us on the Facebook group. You can just search for Disaster Podcast on Facebook and ask to join the group. We'd love to have you come in and join the community there, about 600 folks or so. And we post episodes there. We offer opportunities for questions. Other articles get posted by members of the community as they come up. And it's just a great opportunity to reach out to people that are interested in the program and what we do on a weekly basis here at the Disaster Podcast. Sam, I think this is a fantastic topic this week. I always enjoy and look forward to these clinical segments with Joe. And I think it's because it you know, disasters present in so many different ways. And, you know, the disaster that is sweeping the country right now of the opioid epidemic and the overdoses that we're running into on a regular basis, it really is a disaster in the way it's taxing our resources and making it difficult for us to manage these patients. And then we are probably, according to Joe, maybe overlooking some things in some cases. And it just is important for us to really understand that in this situation, disaster medicine is not what we were expecting sometimes.
Well, and if you take it a step further, there's the personal level of disaster. Someone that may have survived a stroke or something, and then suddenly they've got this huge rhabdo issue going on. So disasters happen at every level, but it's pretty clear, however we define it, disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.